Israeli forces opened the gates of its rainwater stores east of Gaza, allowing rainwater to flood large swaths of Palestinian land. The Palestinian Ministry of Agriculture said in a statement that the water drowned thousands of meters of agricultural lands and damaged wheat and other winter crops. This led to great financial losses for farmers.
Every year in this time, Israeli army opens the rainwater gates to flood our lands and destroy the crops. Israel also sprays harmful herbicides at our land, damaging all the farms and crops planted. These attempts aim at forcing us to leave this land. We stress that these attempts won't make us leave. We will remain here.
In violation of international standards, Israeli army also shoot at Palestinian farmers to push them off their lands and spray herbicides beside the buffer zone along the Gaza Strip, something directly affects the livelihood of Palestinians.
This is the second time in a month the Israeli army has opened its water gates and flooded our agricultural lands. All the winter crops are now destroyed here. This means a great financial loss for the farmers and even consumers. Our life as a farmer is under risk of being shot by Israeli army.
The Ministry of Agriculture says the move hampers transference of Gaza's main source of fruits and vegetables.
Over thousands of meters of our lands have been destroyed this time. Opening rainwater gates is a move by Israeli army to force us to leave our lands and damage the main food supply for Gaza. Drowning these crops will not only damage the planted crops, but also the lands.
Palestinians here say the living conditions have been deteriorating due to the Israeli blockade. They say Israel is now making the bad situation worse by damaging their agricultural lands and causing them financial losses. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
In the Rohingya refugee camp in the outskirts of New Delhi, there is an utter panic and the residents are fearful even going out to buy the essentials. They say many are chased, intimidated, and usually police and other agencies visit their camps to monitor their movements. Ali Johar, a young Rohingya refugee, says several have been arrested in the recent months and put into jails for illegally entering India, saying the whole community is in utter despair.
Around 60 people have been arrested in the different parts of India, including West Bengal, Manipur, Assam, Haryana, and Delhi. In Delhi, around 8 people were detained. In Haryana, several families were harassed to leave out from Haryana.
Fearful of possible arrest and expulsion, scores of refugees have gone into hiding across the Indian subcontinent, while others have entered Bangladesh amid a mounting hate campaign against the community in India. The destitute community, who has escaped what the United Nations described genocide, is struggling for existence amid international silence about their plight. An estimated 40,000 are living in India. The community has faced a brutal crackdown by the army in their country, such as rape, murder, child killings, arbitrary arrests, forced disappearances, as well as destruction of the entire Rohingya villages. Now many fear that the military coup might make the situation even worse. Some reports suggest hundreds of Rohingya are being held in Indian jails on charges of illegal entry and have no proper judicial support. Their men are unable to find work due to lack of identity cards and threats of intimidation by law enforcement agencies forcing men to stay at their camps.
We have been living here peacefully since 2012. We came to save our lives, but the police and other agencies are usually coming to our camps for questioning, asking our IDs, and this has become a routine. We are terrified and we can't even sleep, thinking what would happen to us.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have risen since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of BJP in 2014. Since then, many anti-Rohingya campaigns and Hindu groups have been demanding their expulsion, while the government describes them as security threat. Observers say the Rohingya refugees in particular have in the past and present been used largely for political reasons in this part of the world. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Yemenis have come together before the UN office in Sana'a to call on the international community to step in under pressure the Saudi-led coalition into releasing detained oil vessels. The detention of oil vessels has left the country in desperate struggle to survive amid a harsh shortage of fuel.
We have lots of problems amid fuel shortage. We stay here for days to get some liters of gasoline due to the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition and the continued detention of oil ships. We call on those who are after making concessions against the enemies to stand firm when it comes to the basic needs of Yemeni people.
Major sectors including health have warned that they may collapse in a few days if the detained oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition are not immediately released. Thousands of facilities have already stopped providing services due to a lack of fuel.
The situation today is entirely catastrophic, especially in the health sector. The petroleum company is unable to provide health facilities with the oil derivatives. 50 days have passed and not even a lift has been allowed to enter the port of Hodeidah. The U.S. and the U.N. bear responsibility of what is happening in Yemen.
The Saudi-led coalition is still holding 14 Yemeni oil ships illegally as they were inspected and authorized by the United Nations through verification and inspection mechanism. Hundreds of cars take days in long lines in front of the only working gas station in Sana'a. Yemenis say overcoming this dire situation needs a real action by the international community to step in and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
The prosecutor's office against hate crimes in Barcelona says it sees sufficient evidence to investigate Spain's far right for allegedly inciting hatred against Muslims following a complaint by several Muslim communities in Catalonia. At the core of the controversy is a video published online by the nativist ultra-nationalist party Vox during the recent election campaign in Catalonia.
The video falsely claims the entire Muslim community in Catalonia is responsible for the 2017 terrorist attacks in Barcelona. It purportedly shows footage of women in burqas in mosques that was actually shot in Afghanistan and other countries.
Vox's Twitter account was temporarily suspended at the end of January for breaching the company's hate speech regulations with false accusations and unfounded claims against Muslims in Catalonia.
Their strategy is to polarize society, to create fear and manipulate that fear in order to antagonize communities. This is an old mechanism that underlies all forms of racism. It alienates the others by labeling them as foreigners. It goes back centuries in the Iberian Peninsula, and that is where you need to start in order to understand the rise of Islamophobia in Spain.
Vox won 11 seats in Catalonia's regional parliament. Their aggressive campaign against Muslims has raised awareness among community leaders to re-examine their alliances.
We regret the silence of political parties in Catalonia in this election. While they all wooed Muslim voters, not a single one had the courage to stand up and denounce the Islamophobic, xenophobic attacks against our country.
Although Catalonia is home to nearly 500,000 Muslims and has elected its first Muslim female member of parliament in 2017, it does not have a central cultural center or great mosque to this day.
Unlike in previous suits against the far right, representatives of the Muslim community in Catalonia say they believe they have a solid case against Vox. They trust the courts will do them justice this time around. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی. مسافرین گرامی، خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The debate.
If you thought white supremacists was a U.S. problem, think again. According to the UN, white supremacists and neo-Nazis are becoming a transnational threat. Why would this elevate to a threat level at this point? Another key question, how have the groups taken advantage of the pandemic to boost their support? That's what the UN has said. Just some of the questions we will be asking our guests in this edition of the debate.
The UN Secretary General says white supremacy and the rise of neo-Nazi groups are becoming a transnational threat, warning that the coronavirus pandemic is not helping things. Antonio Guterres told the UN Human Rights Council that risk amounts to terrorism.
We must also step up the fight against resurgent neo-Nazism, white supremacy, and racially and ethnically motivated terrorism. The danger of these hate-driven movements is growing by the day. Let us call them what they are. White supremacy and neo-Nazi movements are more than domestic terror threats. They are becoming a transnational threat. These and other groups have exploited the pandemic to boost their ranks through social polarization and political and cultural manipulation.
Guterres did not name any states, but he warned that groups preaching hate are now the number one internal security threat for several countries. The U.S. has been under the spotlight for racially motivated tensions over the past years, more than any other country. Racial tensions simmered under the presidency of Donald Trump, with some months-long protests triggered by the murder of unarmed African-American George Floyd in the hands of white police officers in 2020. Many described it as the most serious social unrest in the U.S. since the civil rights movement of the 1960s. But at least for U.S. officials, nothing was as serious as the siege of the Capitol Hill building, but what incumbent President Joe Biden called thugs, insurrectionists, political extremists, and white supremacists. Guterres hinted at the incident when he warned of hate groups being cheered by people in position of responsibility. Trump openly slammed anti-fascist protests against right-wing extremism amid cheers by white supremacists. But he's not the only Western leader to have attempted to bring back pro-racism rhetoric to center stage. Far-right political parties are now a new reality of politics across Europe. The continent has also been struck by neo-Nazi protests. Far-right politics and protests have been taking different forms, with Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and the Netherlands being some of the hotbeds recently. But a few commonalities tie them all together. They attempt to revive toxic notions of white superiority by stoking fear of religious, ethnic, and racial minorities with a focus on Islam, immigrants, and non-whites. That's sugar-coated with models of defense against threats encroaching on what they tend to call accepted Western values. In May 2019, Italian Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini led a rally of his European far-right allies in Milan. There, he vowed to remold Europe by crackdown on immigrants while protecting the perceived European civilization. That was foreshadowed by international gatherings of neo-Nazi groups in Germany, Poland, and the U.S. Guterres now warns that this is leading to a growing network of hateful ideologies.
Individuals and groups are engaged in a feeding frenzy of hate, fundraising, recruiting, and communicating online, both at home and overseas, traveling internationally to train together and network their hateful ideologies.
The rise of far-right has led to a surge in attacks on minorities in Western countries, including Britain, France, Germany, and the U.S., where authorities have been reporting hundreds of racially charged attacks on Muslims and mosques for over the past years. During the coronavirus pandemic, such incidents have also taken the new shape of certain restrictions on minorities' access to medical care and vaccines. Warnings like the one from the UN chief have been there for some time, but a problem lingers on in the absence of meaningful action from Western governments.
We're joining us for this edition of the debate, editor at Culture Wars online magazine, E. Michael Jones, joins us from South Bend, Indiana. We also have author and broadcaster Jonathan Fryer, who joins us from London. Gentlemen, welcome. If I may first start with you, Michael Jones, and ask your reaction about what the UN has said, well, what the UN has warned us about, that white supremacists and neo-Nazi groups are becoming a transnational threat. Tell us how that has happened, in your opinion, and why has it become a threat now, not before?
Let me begin by saying that in all the years that I've been contributing to Press TV, this has got to be one of the dumbest, most preposterous statements I have ever heard in my life, okay? This is a complete fabrication on the part of the oligarchs to demonize a group of people who are simply trying to stay alive and survive under really horrible conditions. I'm talking about the United States of America. Okay, I'm going to go one step further, and I'm going to say there are no white people in the United States of America. White is a political category that is based on certain characteristics that gets imposed on groups of people for political purposes to demonize them. That's what's going on here. It's that simple. There's no threat in the United States, and there's certainly no international threat. This is pure oligarch speech.
So, okay, pure oligarch speech there, Jonathan Fryer, is what our guest there is saying. And also, if I understood him correctly, he has blasted the statement coming from the UN. In particular, it came from the UN Secretary General that is calling, or is making the statement, white supremacists, in reference perhaps to the U.S. here. Is Michael Jones there justified in his anger, I should say?
Well, I listened with great interest to what Michael had to say, but I disagree completely. I think that the UN Secretary General was quite correct. There really is a problem, not only in North America, but also here in Europe. Indeed, European intelligence agencies, including the British MI5, the Internal Intelligence Agency, have stepped up its monitoring of far-right white extremist groups and individuals ahead of the previously the attention focused mainly on Islamist extremists. There really is a problem, and this has got worse during the COVID pandemic. We saw it with the Proud Boys who marched with others on the Capitol Hill last month in Washington. We've seen it here in Britain and in other European countries. And several far-right politicians have taken advantage of the proportional representation in countries like the Netherlands to win seats in the parliament of the different countries. And indeed, Marine Le Pen, the head of the right-wing group, which is overtly anti-Islamic, is highly likely to win at least the first round of the presidential election, though she may be defeated in the second round, thanks to the French political system.
Mm-hmm. Well, Michael Jones, the anger that you expressed on what the UN Secretary General has said somewhat parallels what the U.S. President Joe Biden said recently, that white supremacists are the greatest domestic terror threat in the U.S., and calling, and let me just read off, calling what people who support them or their ideals demented and dangerous. I'm guessing you don't agree with Joe Biden, do you?
No. The Secretary of the UN got it from Joe Biden. It's obvious. This is the oligarch narrative. Okay, I have a question for my colleague in London. Okay, is Mr. Salvini white?
He would self-identify as white, and I, unfortunately, many of the supporters of the Liga in Italy are supporters of white supremacy. And although the white European might be a broad definition ethnically, it's what people identify as. And in America, there's a group, not just the Proud Boys, other groups who have targeted non-white immigrants, particularly coming from Central America and Mexico, and also Islamic groups. Here in Europe, it's more the Islamic minorities in countries like France and the Netherlands, they self-identify as white, and quite rightly say there was an awful lot of...
Is he in a...
On Twitter at the time,
okay.
Black Lives Matter, of white people standing up and saying, white lives matter, we matter.
Okay, go ahead. Michael Jones.
Yeah, there was an article in the New York Times when the Italians became white. Okay, there was a time here in America when Italians were not white. Okay, now we have a situation where this category of white is being imposed on anybody that the government doesn't like. Okay, so I was involved in this situation here this summer. St. Louis, there's a statue. Everybody's tearing down statues this summer, and there's a statue of St. Louis, the patron of the city. Okay, this statue has to come down. Well, why? I mean, it's not Robert E. Lee. What's going on here? Is St. Louis white? So the man who's orchestrating this campaign says it's white supremacists who are defending the statue of St. Louis. Well, you look into the story, and it turns out those white supremacists are praying the rosary. Is this something that white supremacists do? No, it's something the Catholics do. And so what we're seeing here, the classic example of what I'm talking about, this is identity theft. Anytime you use the word white, you are engaging in identity theft. And so the whole narrative here is, as soon as you identify a group as white, they've lost the battle. Because as soon as you're white, you're racist. And as soon as you're racist, you have no rights. So I entered into this discussion, wrote an article on it. Within hours of posting the article on the internet, this guy, Umar Lee, challenges me to a debate in which I changed the narrative. So it's not a battle between white supremacists and black people. It's a battle between Catholics and Jews, because the Jews are the only people who are concerned about Louis, King Louis of France, because he burned the Talmud. This is a type of misdirection that is being orchestrated by the people who run the show now in the United States, and now the idiots who are in charge of the United Nations are too stupid to understand what's going on.
I think we got six topics out of what statements there that E. Michael Jones just made. I'm trying to break that down in my head. I'm having a tough time wrapping my head around some of the things that you said, E. Michael Jones. I'm going to come back to you, though, because I'm going to give the floor now to Jonathan Fryer. Jonathan Fryer, there's a map that has about 20 countries in Europe that have nationalist parties that came into power just very recently. You could talk about, well, gosh, that covers quite a number of countries, Italy, France, Spain, you name it. Why have white nationalists actually struck such a chord with the population itself, at large, I should say, for them to come into power and hold political posts?
Well, because essentially they've been talking to grievances among a certain proportion of white people. But I think we need to make the distinction between white people and white supremacists. Although white supremacists are white as they see it, they are nonetheless very different from the majority of white people who have embraced the multiculturalism of the European and indeed European Union and of the United Kingdom. But what we've seen right across Europe, from Hungary through to Spain and Portugal, is the recent arrival of strong minority opinion amongst white disenfranchised people who feel that they have grievances against the state, either the state is handling the COVID epidemic badly, or that they ought to get the virus protection, the vaccine, before the minority communities. And we're seeing a very difficult situation here in Europe. As I say, it's definitely happening. It's not a figment of imagination of Antonio Guterres, and it's not even something that's coming originate from the United States, I don't believe. I really think there is a problem here in Europe that's been developing over several years, long before the pandemic began, and which is largely because of the large influx of Islamic migrants to Hungary and Poland and other parts of Europe who came from Syria in particular. And although Germany opens doors and welcome, the right-wing groups in other countries, on the contrary, have been very antagonistic to these new arrivals. And we've seen within the Mediterranean countries, Italy, Spain, and so on, a backlash against these new arrivals, and the backlash against Islam. That I don't agree at all with Michael, who said that this is a Christian or Catholic versus Jews. This is more Christian civilization versus Islamic civilization. For those in Britain, majority, it's not a problem. But for white extremists, it is a problem.
Okay, well, E. Michael Jones, I want to go back to your statements there. And please walk us through, if you can, in the first angle that I'd like to ask you on is your general statement where you said the U.S. is not white. I'm trying to understand why this label white now is being used in your eyes by the government, what the reasons are, the motives behind the government to look at it in the angle and lens that you are. I mean, if you can back that up for us a little bit here.
Yes. The motive is political control. As soon as a group is white, they're bad because they're racist. So if they can get you to identify as white, you already lost. Charlottesville, classic example of what I'm talking about. So what is a white guy? Okay, there are people who identify as white. It's a Protestant, doesn't go to church anymore. Okay, and what I'm talking about now is the real theory of ethnicity. It's a word we have to bring up here. Ethnicity is the antithesis of race in this instance. Okay, and there's a theory about American ethnicity, and it's called the triple melting pot, sociological theory, that says after the generations in America, your ethnicity is determined by your religion. That is what happened in St. Louis. So there are three ethnic groups in America. They're Protestant, Catholic, and Jew. That's your identity. That's your ethnic identity in America. That's what the oligarchs are trying to destroy. That's what I restored when I wrote the article about St. Louis. That's the real dynamic about what's going on here. Whether my colleague agrees with me or not, that's the story in America. It's ethnic. And I'm not white. I'm biracial. I'm Irish and I'm German. Now, how that these things are all being erased in a massive campaign of identity theft.
Well, this brings about the whole notion of going to waste, Jonathan Fryer, multiculturalism, whether it's religious multiculturalism or any type that would fall under that umbrella, from, as I mentioned, religion to race to you name it. But we're having consequences of tensions which has amounted to violence and acts such as xenophobia. I mean, that's what happened in Europe, that forced the MEPs in the European Parliament to take firm action against neo-fascist, as they call the neo-Nazi groups. And maybe some people don't know what a neo-fascist group perhaps is. So hasn't the negative notions, what is at the heart of this problem, again, violence perhaps being one of the negative consequences?
Well, I think it's at the heart of the problem is the fact, as the Secretary General of the UN rightly pointed out, the fact that these groups are talking to each other, that Steve Bannon from the United States is in close contact with far-right groups here in Europe, and that European MEPs of different parties have realized that they have much in common, that Schatwilders in the Netherlands or the new Vox Party in the Iberian Peninsula are meeting together and are discussing things together and realizing that they have common cause, which is to attack the white majority from a white supremacist point of view, so that they claim that the white majority is the establishment of Europe. But the white majority is not listening to the white minority, the white supremacists, who argue that not only is white right, white is best, and that therefore we should be better if you support the white people. And this is a narrative that appeals to certain people, particularly of little education, who have a lot of pressures on them at the moment, particularly during the pandemic. The unemployment rate has risen in Europe as it has in the United States, and not everybody receives the sort of help that is available from the government. And therefore, they are approving this sort of message that is coming across from a minority. It's a minority which has a voice and which is able, through social media these days, to communicate with each other as well as communicate with the general population.
Okay, my final question goes to you, E. Michael Jones. The statement that the U.N. Secretary General has made is in reference to the politicians who have this notion of white supremacy. How can, quote, we need global coordinated action to defeat this grave and growing danger. So what does he propose to do? I mean, what does he have as a game plan, do you
what
think?
What he's got is a worldwide rebellion against the oligarchs. That's what's going on. India is part of this. The yellow vest, Brexit, Trump, all sorts of people are upset with oligarchic rule. These are not white supremacists. I'm trying to tell you, it's their category. If you collaborate by putting this label on people who are upset with the oligarchic rule, you're working for the oligarchs. It's a category of the mind. You should be able to see through this and see the political purpose behind it. If you can't, you're part of the problem.
Very well. We're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. Very enlightening indeed. Let me thank our guest, editor of Culture Wars Online Magazine, Michael Jones, there with his statements, and author and broadcaster Jonathan Fryer. Pleasure. Talk to us from London. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Ikaw Itapwa, my entire team in the capital, Tehran. It's goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. Across the plains of West Texas, the pump jacks that resemble giant bobbing hammers define not just the landscape, but the state itself. Texas has been built on the oil and gas business for the last 120 years, ever since the discovery of oil on Spindletop Hill near Beaumont, Texas in 1901. Texas, the nation's leading energy-producing state, seemed like the last place on Earth that could run out of energy. Then last week, it did. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Clifford Krause, Manny Fernandez, Ivan Penn, David Montgomery, and Rick Rojas. The piece is titled, How Texas's Drive for Energy Independence Set It Up for Disaster. Stay with us for more. Across the plains of West Texas, the pump jacks that resemble giant bobbing hammers define not just the landscape, but the state itself. Texas has been built on the oil and gas business for the last 120 years, ever since the discovery of oil on Spindletop Hill near Beaumont, Texas in 1901. Texas, the nation's leading energy-producing state, seemed like the last place on Earth that could run out of energy. Then last week, it did. The crisis could be traced to that other defining Texas trait, independence, both from big government and from the rest of the country. The dominance of the energy industry and the Republic of Texas ethos became a devastating liability when energy stopped flowing to millions of Texans who shivered and struggled through a snowstorm that paralyzed much of the state. Part of the responsibility for the near collapse of the state's electrical grid can be traced to the decision in 1999 to embark on the nation's most extensive experiment in electrical deregulation, handing control of the state's entire electricity delivery system to a market-based patchwork of private generators, transmission companies, and energy retailers. The energy industry wanted it. The people wanted it. Both political parties supported it. Competition in the electric industry will benefit Texans by reducing monthly rates and offering consumers more choices about the power they use, George W. Bush, then the governor of Texas, said as he signed the top-to-bottom deregulation legislation. George W. Bush's prediction of lower-cost power generally came true, and the dream of a free-market electrical grid worked reasonably well most of the time, in large part because Texas had so much cheap natural gas, as well as abundant wind power to power renewable energy. But the newly deregulated system came with few safeguards and even fewer enforced rules. With so many cost-conscious utilities competing for budget-shopping consumers, there was little financial incentive to invest in weather protection and maintenance. Wind turbines are not equipped with the de-icing equipment routinely installed in the colder climes of the Dakotas, and power lines have little insulation. The possibility of more frequent cold weather events was never built into the infrastructure plans in a state where climate change remains an exotic, disputed concept. Deregulation was something akin to abolishing the speed limit on an interstate highway, said Edward Herz, an energy fellow at the University of Houston. That opens up shortcuts that cause disasters. The state's entire energy infrastructure was walloped with glacial temperatures that even under the strongest of regulations might have frozen gas wells and downed power lines. But what went wrong in Texas was far broader. Deregulation meant that critical rules of the road for power were set not by law, but rather by a dizzying array of energy competitors. Utility regulation is intended to compensate for the natural monopolies that occur when a single electrical provider serves an area. It keeps prices down whilst protecting public safety and guaranteeing fair treatment to consumers. Yet many states have flirted with deregulation as a way of giving consumers more choices and encouraging new providers, especially alternative energy producers. California, for example, one of the early deregulators in the 1990s, scaled back its initial foray after market manipulation led to skyrocketing prices and rolling blackouts. States like Maryland allowed customers to pick from a menu of producers. In some states, competing private companies offer varied packages like discounts for cheaper power at night. But no state has gone as far as Texas, which has not only turned over the keys to the free market, but has also isolated itself from the national grid, limiting the state's ability to import power when its own generators are foundering. Consumers themselves got a direct shock last week when customers who had chosen variable-rate electricity contracts found themselves with power bills of $5,000 or even more. When they were expecting extra low monthly rates, many may now face huge bills as a result of the upswing in wholesale electricity prices during the cold wave. The governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, on Sunday said the state's Public Utility Commission has issued a moratorium on customer disconnections for for non-payment and will temporarily restrict providers from issuing invoices. There is regulation in the Texas system, but it is hardly robust. One nonprofit agency, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT, was formed to manage the wholesale market. It is supervised by the Public Utility Commission, which also oversees the transmission companies that offer customers an exhaustive array of contract choices laced with more fine print than a credit card agreement. But both agencies are nearly unaccountable and toothless compared to regulators in other regions, where many utilities have stronger consumer protections and submit an annual planning report to ensure adequate electricity supply. Texas energy companies are given wide latitude in their planning and for catastrophic events. One example of how Texas has gone it alone is its refusal to enforce a reservoir margin of extra power available above expected demand, unlike all other power systems around North America. With no mandate, there is little incentive to invest in precautions for events, such as a southern snowstorm, that are very rare. Any company that took such precautions would put itself at a competitive disadvantage. A surplus supply of natural gas, the dominant power fuel in Texas, near power plants might have helped avoid the cascade of failures in which power went off, forcing natural gas production and transmission offline, which in turn led to further power shortages. In the aftermath of the days-long power outages, ERCOT has been criticized by both Democratic and Republican residents, lawmakers, and business executives, a rare display of unity in a fiercely partisan and Republican-dominated state. The governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, said he supported calls for the agency's leadership to resign and made ERCOT reform a priority for the legislature. The reckoning has been swift. This week, lawmakers will hold hearings in Austin to investigate the agency's handling of the snowstorm and the rolling power outages. For ERCOT operators, the storm's arrival was swift and fierce, but they had anticipated it and knew it would strain their system. They asked power customers across the state to conserve, warning that power outages were likely. But late on Sunday, 14th of February, it rapidly became clear that the snowstorm was far worse than anything they had expected. Sleet and snow fell, and temperatures plunged. In the council's command center outside Austin, a room dominated by screens flashing with maps, graphics, and data tracking the flow of electricity to 26 million people in Texas, workers quickly found themselves fending off a crisis. As the weather worsened into Monday morning, 15th of February, residents cranked up their heaters and the demand surged. Power plants began falling offline in rapid succession as they were overcome by the frigid weather or ran out of fuel to burn. Within hours, 40% of the power supply in Texas had been lost. The entire grid, carrying 90% of the electric load in Texas, was barreling towards a collapse. In the electricity business, supply and demand need to be in balance. Imbalances lead to catastrophic blackouts. Recovering from a total blackout would be an agonizing and tedious process, known as a black start, that could take weeks or even months. And in the early morning hours last Monday, the Texas grid was seconds and minutes away from such a collapse, according to Bill Magnus, the president and chief executive of the Electric Reliability Council, ERCOT. If we had allowed a catastrophic blackout to happen, we wouldn't be talking today about hopefully getting most customers their power back, Mr. Magnus said. We'd be talking about how many months it might take before you get back your power. The power outages and the cold weather touched off an avalanche of failures, but there had been warnings long before last week's snowstorm. After a heavy snowstorm in February of 2011 caused statewide rolling blackouts and left millions of Texans in the dark, federal authorities warned the state that its power infrastructure had been inadequate. Winterization protection was inadequate. But 10 years later, pipelines remained inadequately insulated and heaters that might have kept instruments from freezing were never installed. During heat waves, when demand has soared during several recent summers, the system in Texas has also strained to keep up, raising questions about lack of reserve capacity under unregulated grid. And aside from the weather, there have been periodic signs that the system can run into trouble delivering sufficient energy, in some cases because of equipment failures, in other cases because of what critics called an attempt to drive up prices, according to Mr. Hurst of the University of Houston, as well as several energy consultants. Another potential safeguard might have been far stronger connections to the two interstate power-sharing networks, East and West, that allow states to link their electrical grids and obtain power from thousands of miles away when needed to hold down costs and offset their own shortfalls. But Texas, reluctant to submit to the federal regulation that is part of the regional power grid, made decision as far back as the early 20th century to become the only state in the continental United States to operate its own grid, a plan that leaves it able to borrow only from a few close neighbors. The border city of El Paso survived the freeze much better than Dallas or Houston because it was not part of the Texas grid, but connected to the much larger grid covering many western states. But the problems that began with last Monday's storm went beyond an isolated electrical grid. The entire ecosystem of how Texas generates, transmits, and uses power stalled as millions of Texans shivered in darkness, unheated, and in unheated homes. Texans love to brag about natural gas, which state officials often call their cleanest burning fossil fuel. No state produces more, and gas-fired power plants produce nearly half of Texas's electricity. We are struggling to come to grips with the reality that gas came up short and let us down when we needed it most, said Michael E. Weber, a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. The cold was so severe that the enormous oil and natural gas fields of West Texas froze up or could not get sufficient power to operate. Though a few plants had stored gas reserves, there was insufficient electricity to pump it. The leaders of ERCOT defended the organization, its lack of mandated reserves, and the state's isolation from the larger regional grids, and said the blame for the power crisis lies with the weather, not the overall deregulated system in Texas. The historic, just about unprecedented snowstorm was the heart of the problem, Mr. Magnus, the council's chief executive, said. Magnus added, "We've found that this market structure works. It demands reliability. I don't think there's a silver bullet market structure that could have managed extreme lows and generation outages that we were facing on Sunday night." In Texas, energy regulation is as much a matter of philosophy as policy. Its independent power grid is a point of pride that has been an applause line in Texas political speeches for decades. Deregulation is a hot topic among Texas energy experts, and there has been no shortage of predictions that the grid could fail under stress. But there has not been widespread public dissatisfaction with the system, although many are now wondering if they're being well served.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.